Hey, this is a Dark Tangent, organizer of DEF CON. You're about to listen to some speeches from DEF CON 3, held July 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1995. Now, the Tropicana has since been renovated. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, all rights reserved, the Dark Tangent, and DEF CON Communications. Permission is expressly granted, though, for educational, non-profit use. If you have any more questions about DEF CON, or want to send me some email about the copyright status, please email me at dt@defcon.org, or the website is www.defcon.org. Now, kick back, get ready for some good speeches, and thanks for supporting it. Get in here. PSR.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, why don't you come on up, too. This is supposed to be a panel. I managed to bring one other person, so I thought that was pretty good. It's hard to get volunteers. So we're a panel of two. We're a round table. I'm told we're a round table. It's very hard to do a two, but that's okay. We're from Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. I'm Karen Coyle. This is Jim Davis. CPSR is one of those goody-two-shoes organizations that's trying to make everything nice for everybody. Our main concern is the interaction between computers and society and what this does to us and to our communities. We've been doing a lot of work around this thing called the NII, this great piece of federal vaporware, the National Information Infrastructure. Trying to sort of help people sort out what's real and what isn't, and of course most of it isn't. So I have set some little brochures out on a table out there and some more information about us. People often wonder about our name, Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, and want to know if they have to be a computer professional to join. And I always say this is actually the best deal you can get. Give us $45 and you are a computer professional. Or you could even go low income for 20, and it doesn't get better than that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's happened since last DEF CON. We were here at the last DEF CON talking, and this has been really a banner year for repression in our country. This has been the year that, for the first time, that the commercial domain, .com, has become the largest internet domain, surpassing the .edu, the education domain, for the first time since the internet was founded, since 1981. So the internet is now predominantly a commercial system. This is also the year that companies like Netscape made it possible to conduct commercial transactions over the net. Isn't that wonderful of them? It's the year that we saw our first advertising blurbs appear on our screens, whether we wanted to or not, and it's legal. It's also the year the first website was sold. GNN, the O'Reilly site, was sold to AOL. Cyberspace has finally become real estate. You can buy it and sell it. This is the year that Congress began discussing massive deregulation of the business of telecommunications. And this is the year that Congress began discussing massive regulation of the content of our communications, with things like the Communications Decency Act, the Anti-Terrorism Act, and now the Anti-Racketeering Act. We're spending more energy trying to keep people from getting to quote-unquote bad stuff on the net than we are in trying to help them find the really great stuff out there. And this is the year that the telecommunications business went on a world-class feeding frenzy, buying and selling and merging and everything else to the tune of market potential, even though at this point no one really is making a profit off this thing. At the same time, the telecom companies are adopting a downsizing as their workforce technique, anticipating upcoming battle for the market, which they presumably think is going to be won by the lean and mean. So more telecom workers are losing their jobs. And it's the year that computer crime, child pornography, and explosives made headlines in places like Time Magazine and all the TV infotainment shows. with very little understanding of what crime, pornography, and explosives might have to do with the Internet, until, of course, the general public now thinks that the Internet is just the most dangerous place to be. So I'm going to do a little, I'm not sure how well this is going to work, unless you've really got your thinking caps on. I'm lucky I have it written here in front of me. I'm going to try to go through just month by month and highlight a few of the interesting things that I think are happening. And then Jim is going to talk about how you might fit into this world of this changing world of communications, and then we can take some questions and answers. And I should be starting with August of 1994 because that was when the last DEF CON was. But I have to start with July because it just ties in so well. So July of 1994, headline, "The feds are seeking Kevin Mitnick for breaking the terms of his probation and for posing as a law enforcement officer to obtain information." August of 1994, one of the Clinton administration's task forces that's working on the NII came out with something called the Green Paper on Intellectual Property. This is basically proposals for new changes to the copyright laws. It has some very interesting bits and pieces in it which you should pay attention to. For one thing, it says that all transmissions, all computer transmissions, even from a hard drive to a screen on the same machine, is an act of copy as defined by copyright. It also proposes hefty legal penalties for anyone who attempts to defeat a copyright scheme. Also in August, we have a headline saying that Intel plans a huge fall campaign for Pentium, its latest and most powerful computer chip. And in August, an employee at Lawrence Livermore National Lab was charged with a felony for storing 50 gigabytes of pornographic images on a lab computer. This guy just, you know, like, has a little problem with scale, you know. In September of 94, the digital telephony bill is being discussed in the House Judiciary Committee. This would require telephone companies to ensure that their networks are accessible to law enforcement wiretaps, and we get to pay for it. Also in September, we have some interesting job information. GTE California cuts 350 hourly jobs. 1,400 workers at Nippon Telegraph in Japan take early retirement. 10,000 Ameritech employees take early retirement. And the National Labor Relations Board asked Sprint to rehire 246 Hispanic workers that they fired because they were sympathetic to the union. In October, on October 30th, as a matter of fact, a nice person, Mr. Professor Nicely, posts a note to the net saying that he's been doing some calculations of prime numbers on his Pentium, and guess what? They aren't coming out right. In November of 1994, there were hearings about these copyright laws that are being proposed. And there's some very interesting things being said. There are four hearings held across the country, and the majority of the people showing up, of course, are from large communications companies and entertainment companies. You had everything, Time Warner, MGM, all of those. And they're there to talk about how copyright needs to be tightened up so that they can make more money in the electronic environment. And here's some of my favorite quotes from these people. This is from someone named Massey, who's president and CEO of the Commerce Clearinghouse that publishes law books. He says, "We're concerned about the use of metaphors for the NII, such as information highway, digital library, or universal service, that imply that all of the information available might be free." A spokesman for West Publishing, that has the monopoly on legal information in the U.S., says, "A continuing education program is necessary to reverse the present and growing attitude of many citizens that work should be free for the taking in the electronic environment." And then a Mr. Simons from the Dialogue Company, one of the largest information database, online database providers in the world, has this to say, "We believe that we actually were helpful in blazing the trail and cutting down the trees over which the highway will be paved in the near future." only about three people came up to speak for the need for public access for information, free access to information, and any kind of service-type access, such as libraries, schools, that type of thing. Everyone else basically wanted to sell their information. We'll discuss that. So in November of 94, Netscape is introduced for the first time. It adds security features that will enable users to purchase products over the net. Also in November, MathWorks develops a software fix for the Pentium error that was discovered in October. Intel so far has come up with nothing. However, just then the news about Pentium hits the press, and Intel management posts a note on AOL explaining that the error really isn't important to most users and that it will replace the processors, but only for power users. In that same month, Bell Atlantic suspends 1,100 workers in Pennsylvania for showing up to work on Thanksgiving Day wearing T-shirts depicting themselves as roadkill on the information highway because they'd heard rumors that Bell Atlantic was going to be cutting its workforce. In December, IBM stopped shipping machines with Pentiums, and the Pentium panic has really begun. And Intel, in a shift, offers free replacement of the chip. In Europe, telephone company workers are losing their jobs. The main UK company, Mercury Communications, says that it will cut its staff by one-third. Also in December, a judge drops charges against David LaMacchia for running a BBS at MIT that allowed others to download commercial software. It turned out there was no law that he could be convicted under. And then in a sort of lighter note, in December of 94, we had the first online internet sing-along messiah held by the internet multicasting service, Culture Arrives. January, Intel's fourth quarter net fell 37% due to the Pentium problem. Bell Atlantic decides to expand its video on demand test in Fairfax County, and a day later announces that it's going to close four offices and lay off 1,700 workers. Over the holidays, some mysterious someone has hacked into the secure machine of Shimomura San Diego Supercomputer Center worker. In February, Mitnick is caught through his cell phone use. He's accused of various break-ins, the San Diego Supercomputer Center, Netcom, the well. 3 days later, this is the headline in the New York Times, computer thief scoop nets book deal. Hyperion gives book contract to reporter John Markoff for a book on the arrest of Kevin Mitnick. In February, Jake Baker's online story of rape and torture wins him a visit from the feds. In March, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, the same one that just got rid of 50 gigabytes of porn, releases a program called Courtney to detect the use of Satan. Satan won't be out yet for another 3 weeks. In March, again, Kevin Mitnick is indicted on 23 counts of fraud. And then later on in that month, though not formally charged, Jake Baker spends 29 days in jail for being a danger to society. Early in April of 1994, Satan is released on the net. Over the next 3 or 4 days, the net is flooded with people talking about Satan, all the problems it's causing. These are not people whose computers have been broken into by Satan. These are people who can't get the Perl script to compile. And it turns out that if you try to run it on certain Sun workstations, it hoses the system. So far, not many people have been broken into by it, but they did finally get it to compile. According to the New York Times, in April, there was a surge in discussions on explosives just before the Oklahoma bombing on the internet. I don't know where they got that. And in May, we get the 1995 Omnibus Counterterrorism Act introduced. that proposes to give added power to the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Also in May, Los Angeles's newly formed Special Digital Smut Task Force catches its first criminal, a man accused of possessing child pornography obtained from the Internet. In June, the Senate approves a terrorism bill and it goes on to the House. And Dianne Feinstein adds the explosives information amendment to it. Using the wording of this amendment that she added, we would have to ban the encyclopedia. And many U.S. Department of Agriculture publications that explain to farmers how to rid their fields of stumps using common household products like fertilizer and fuel. The terrorism bill clears the House committee. In June, Progressive Networks, Microsoft, and Netscape Communications all announced development of anti-smut software filters for the Internet. One called SurfWatch is available that will select and filter out all the bad stuff for you so you don't even have to do it yourself. And late in June, charges against Jake Baker are dismissed. He's just spent 29 days in jail for nothing. In July, the telecom bill reaches the House. The language of the Communication Decency Act is not present, but a new amendment requires that TV sets in the future will include technology that allows parents to block reception of certain categories of programs based on their content. In August, nearing a vote on the telecom bill, politicians claim it will create new jobs. A day later, MCI reports a rise in profits and a plan to cut its workforce by 7%. And just 3 days ago, Senator Charles Grassley introduced the Anti-Electronic Racketeering Act of 1995, which would essentially outlaw all non-escrowed encryption. And as of yesterday, the telecom bill has passed. So this is where we are. It's not a cheerful picture, but as you can see, things are moving very quickly in terms of taking control of our communications. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Jim Davis to talk a little bit about the things that we do in CPSR and how we see ourselves and you fitting into the battle that we have to go through on this count.
Thanks, Karen, and thanks to the organizers for pulling this thing together, and thanks for the opportunity for us to speak to you all, and thank you all for coming. I'm going to take a little bit different tack, I think, on some of the things the other speakers have been talking about, the conference. Take this opportunity to step back, look at the big picture, and take a look at really what's at stake at this particular point in history, and offer some thoughts about the significance of what you all are doing. Newt Gingrich has made it okay again to talk about revolution, so I'm going to take his cue and throw some of that stuff in, but look at it in some different, slightly different ways, because there's lots of revolutions that are happening right now, and so I hope you'll bear with me. First off, it's pretty obvious that we're well into a very profound technological revolution. We could go back to probably the 1930s to look for its beginnings in the laboratories of Bell and Siemens and some of the other companies developing new uses for vacuum tubes and so forth. Out of that taking shape in World War II and coming out with full force after the war, the development of electronics and all the technologies that make possible, computers, robotics, new forms of communications, plus a whole host of other technologies that really wouldn't exist without electronics. Most important is probably biotechnology, but also space technologies, material science, and so forth. Now, even though this electronics revolution is maybe 50 years old, the term cybernetics was coined in 1947, I think we still have to be very clear that we're at the very beginning of this revolution. You all probably know much better than I do, but they say the speed of microprocessors is continuing to double every 18 months or so. so that new architectures that are only theoretically possible a few years ago are now becoming practical. And beyond electronics, we're seeing the merger of electronic components with organic molecules to develop a kind of protein or electronic combination chips that will be used in processing and memory that are much, much smaller, much, much more efficient, order of 100,000 times more efficient. And beyond that, we've seen some successful experiments with DNA-based computers. In fact, you could say we're almost on the edge of a new agricultural revolution where engineered bacteria and introduced genes into other animals are going to create a new means, a new way of producing things, in a sense self-replicating, self-automating, self-activating factories. And in the future, perhaps production will be more a process of growing or excreting products rather than assembling or manufacturing them. So we're at the very beginning of this revolution, but it's still, we can start to see the profound effect that it's happening. Sharp in the wake of this electronics revolution or technological revolution is an equally profound economic revolution. In its wake, we see a world economy being reorganized around what the new technologies make possible. It's taken a while for people to really figure out how to use things like networks and digital communications and dispersed production and so forth in the process of making things, but we're seeing the effects where perhaps designs are done in Silicon Valley and shipped to Indonesia, where the manufacturing of components is done, which are shipped back to Texas where assembly is carried out, and then from then dispersed to all corners of the world for sale. We see where jobs leave, say, a Detroit where a worker might make $15 an hour to a factory in Mexico where they might make $15 a day. And this is really only possible, this kind of global production on the scale that we're seeing now is only possible because of electronics, because of the communication technology and the transportation technology that makes this economically feasible. Now, we could certainly discuss the exact specifics or the chain of dependencies or the network of interdependencies of this technological revolution, the economic revolution, but I hope that we can at least agree on that both of these things are happening. That is, there is a profound change in the way things are being done, and there's a profound change in the economy that's underway. And I think at the heart of that is the ability with electronics to record the capabilities of the human being in software and apply them to hardware capable of replaying that software ad infinitum, replaying the capabilities of the human being ad infinitum in the absence of the worker. So in this profound change, we need to make no mistake about it that this economic revolution is being driven by the lords and masters of the economy. That is, in our economy, call it what it is, it's capitalism, as a primary driving goal, and that's to maximize your profit. That is, if you fail to do that as a capitalist, then you will be driven from the market by your competitor. So there's this compulsion by competing companies to continue to introduce more and more efficient technology. And by efficient technology, what do we mean? We're talking about ways of figuring out how to make more things and sell more things at less cost. And what less cost eventually works its way down to is fewer wages, either by fewer workers or paying them less. So the code words re-engineering and downsizing, which we hear so much in terms of the economy, are not really just terms for corporations, but they're ways of evicting people from the production process, that is, kicking people out of their traditional work. So in its wake of this economic revolution, we see layoffs. It takes many forms. Layoffs, early retirement, the emergence of what is now called the contingent workforce. People who once had steady jobs, steady paychecks, evicted, brought back into the workforce as temps, as contractors, as consultants, as part-timers. Now, this is just kind of to emphasize this is an ad from Business Week from Olson Temporary Services, how to change in a surviving in a changing economy as revealed by Gumby. And the ad says, Olson introduces the flexible workforce. Upturns, downturns, recessions, depressions, sudden recoveries, and slumps. Companies that can't bend with change are companies that can't survive it. Olson has a solution, flexibility. With Olson's flexible workforce, you can reduce overhead and improve efficiency by utilizing people only when you need them. During slower periods, maintain a core staff of full-time workers. During peak periods, supplement that staff with Olson temporary workers. Your staff works more efficiently, more productively, and your company sustains its competitive advantage. So we see this emergence of this Gumby class, and we should be clear that our computer industry is by no means immune from this. I co-edited a newsletter called CPU on working in the computer industry, and just some of the things we reported over the past few years, between 1989 and 1992, over 290,000 jobs lost in the electronics industry. Particularly hard hit were companies that in the mainframe and mini business. IBM, by the time it's done with its kind of paroxysm of change, will be have shrunk from a high of 406,000 workers in 1989 to around 250,000 workers. Digital equipment will have shrunk by half. Other companies like Amdahl, Wang, Group Bull, Fujitsu all have gone through significant layoffs. Also within the microprocessor, microcomputer industry, Apple, Borland, Novell, / WordPerfect, Ashton Tate, rest in peace, all significant layoffs within the past few years. And so I think it's just kind of an interesting aside that Microsoft is a relatively small company, maybe 16,000 workers. Within the Seattle area, they employ maybe 6,000 or 7,000 workers. Boeing has laid off more people in the Seattle area than Microsoft employs there in total. Which is just to say, to throw these numbers at you, that our industry, that the field of our chosen endeavor is by no means exempt from these economic forces. So people aren't needed in the economy in the same way, in the same numbers as they have before. But of course, this hits unevenly. Some people are doing quite well. The top 25% of the income brackets, their income has been rising, where the bottom 25%, their income has been falling. But what we're seeing then is this kind of polarization taking place in our society as this economic revolution works its way through the world economy. So we have some people doing quite well and a growing portion of the population doing quite poorly. Here's a quote from the Wall Street Journal, June 16, 1994. Now, the Wall Street Journal, might remind you, is no left-wing rag. While American industry reaps the benefits of a new high-technology era, it has consigned a large class of workers to a Dickensian time warp, laboring not just for meager wages, but also under dehumanized and often dangerous conditions. Automation, what has liberated thousands from backbreaking drudgery, has created for others a new and insidious toil in many high-growth industries. Work that is faster than ever before, subject to Orwellian control and electronic surveillance, and reduced to limited tasks that are numbingly repetitive, potentially crippling, and stripped of any meaningful skill or chance to develop them. It's that merger of the Dickensian production with the Orwellian control that this person kind of throws in all these literary metaphors that I think is such an ominous sign for this contemporary mode of the way things are done. And some people are, of course, being pushed right out of the economy and scrabbling to hold on to the ship in whatever way possible, either in the shopping cart economy or in the illegal drug trade or the sex industry, whatever. Whole communities cast off from the economy. And in this economy where people, the old social contract was you went and you worked for wages, you took your wages, you bought things at the market that other people made, this cycle of exchange and production that took place in a million different instances throughout the world, once that cash nexus is broken or has started to twist it and shape and being fairly brutal that it is, serious problems start to happen. And so in the wake of this economic revolution, I think we're beginning to see the stirrings of a social revolution that's happening in its wake. That is, people respond, sometimes abruptly, to the disintegration in their community. Situations like the Los Angeles Rebellion in 1992 or the events in Chiapas in early 1994, I think are inevitable response of people to an intolerable situation. So, to bring this back to us, well, one thing I'd like to add and just to note is that the youth, and I think that, you know, by and large, this meeting looks like it's primarily a meeting of young people. And we could arbitrarily pick 30 or 35 or something, maybe even 25. But youth are especially being hit hard in this process of economic reorganization that's taking place. And your personal experience or the experience of friends is probably better than the examples I have, but certainly it's being hit in terms of employment. Some communities, unemployment among youth is up 50-60%. In education, it's harder and harder to get a college education or be able to finish an education within 4 years. In various different sectors, youth, I think, are being hit especially hard, and you get this whole situation where, well, is there a future for us, particularly among teenagers and particularly in inner cities? That is, where certain behaviors, it's because I don't expect to live past 16 or 18 or 20, that this seems to be what's shaping the sociology of these communities. Okay, so what does it have to do with all this? Well, I think one of the questions that we always have to keep in mind, especially us as people who work with and design and create and figure out what this new technology does, always have to keep mindful of, what does this technology make possible? And beyond that, what kind of world do we want to live in? Who is going to decide the future? The future is up for grabs right now. We're at a very peculiar moment in history where we're shifting from one major mode of production to another. Everything in society is being overturned. The thing is up for grabs. The question is, who is going to decide the future? Now, I think it's been pretty clear, some of the signs from Washington. We could look at Clinton's plans and Gingrich's plans. When you look at them on paper, are not tremendously different. That is, their solution is, first off, the really we could say it's the elimination of any function of government except the protection of private property. And by that, we can see the releasing of any constraint on corporate activity to plunder at will. We see the elimination of any kind of social safety net that might be able to be there to support people who fall through in this economic revolution. We see the solution to the social crisis that's emerging as 100,000 more police on the streets, a aggressive plan of new prison construction, the passing of more and more aggressive laws that chip away in more and more profound ways at the Bill of Rights, the increase in executions. And I could go on and on about this, but we're living in very serious times, and this is their sense of how do they maintain the same kind of relations in this new environment, where you have a large portion of the population literally just being pushed outside, no other means of survival. The solution is more police, more prisons, and more repression. Okay, that's kind of, I think, not an overly too simplified view of what their plan is, but what would we want if we had the opportunity to decide that? And I think that some of the, I think it's important that we kind of think about what a vision of the future might look like, and I would suggest one place to start would be looking at what I see as some of the kind of the morality or the spirit that infuses this hacker movement. And that's, I think, to a great deal the spirit of creativity, of exploration, of experimentation, the idea of creation for its own sake, creation because the joy of creation is worth doing. And we see some really exciting projects like the Linux Project or the Free Software Foundation's work or the rich library of freeware that's out there, or even the wonderful products that have made the Internet what it is today that have come out of the public sector, Eudora, the Mosaic, Gopher, Telnet, and so forth. And you all probably know the other underlying technologies also that have emerged from the public sector. And I think that one of the healthiest things is this kind of unwillingness to bow down to this idea of property rights as such in the world. Okay, now, property laws, I think, take on a completely different meaning and lose a lot of their function when you're faced with a situation of absolute abundance. That is, Karen mentioned the idea of information, that we know that information, when it's shared, becomes more useful. That is, the constraint of the sharing of information constrains its optimal use. And thereby, by constraining its use, the ability to share it, to distribute it, means that we get less out of it as a society. Well, the absurdity of information constrained, well, that's, you know, one might say it's not necessarily a life or death situation, but we do have situations where this property rights in the face of abundance take on a much more ominous sign. For example, San Francisco. Maybe official estimates 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 homeless people. Probably actually there's 12,000. 1990 census of housing, 22,000 livable vacant housing units in San Francisco, almost 2 housing units per homeless person in that city. What stands between the homeless person and the place to live?
A job.
The market. Property laws actually is what, when you finally bump up against the thing, it's the policeman there saying, that is somebody's property, get out of there. I think a more awful example is the Burroughs Wellcome enforcement of their patent on AZT. When a company came up with a generic version of the drug, Burroughs Wellcome challenged that they're taking that product to market at a much cheaper rate to alleviate the suffering of AIDS victims, and was successful in defending this property claim on this patent. So the big things at stake. I'd like to, I guess, leave, you know, with this big question again. What kind of world do we want to live in? What's at stake? You can, why don't you give that to us when it's question and answer. So this big question, what kind of world do we want, what kind of society do we want to live in, to take a look and kind of reach into the spirit of this movement and kind of dredge out of that and see, work and figure out how we can make that, the possibilities of that a reality. I think it means some hard work. It means making connections with other portions of people that are starting to get in motion. For example, there's a broad kind of break the blackout movement. A lot of it's happening in culture on the hip-hop movement, fanzines, unlicensed radio, music. We see stuff like the gang truce in Los Angeles, this kind of a resurging student movement. These are all really exciting expressions of people kind of taking up this challenge of what kind of future do we want. So I want to leave that to you and to encourage you to get in touch with other people in your communities. You've got a lot of expertise, a lot of talent that people need, and if we're going to make this new kind of society possible, we're going to need everybody's help. Thanks.
Okay, so now we can do a question and answer. It seems like intellectual property is the main question of the day. So what?
Give me your house, give me all your money, and then I'll write all my books and programs for free. Because you have a lot of parents who say that we should not have children in school because we want to get paid for our programs and our writing.
Yeah, well, that isn't what we said. And as a matter of fact, CPSR is a strong supporter of the National Writers Union, which... Could you wait a moment? Could you wait a moment? Thank you. The copy, I think, I'm going to be very interested in copyright law, and I won't bore you with all of the details of it. The history of copyright law is, to me, very interesting. That over 100 years ago is actually considered something that Congress should deal with, which is the whole issue of how to balance this thing that is considered a public good, which is information and people's thoughts, along with the need for the creator to earn a living or earn money off of that. And the original copyright law, I feel, did that quite well. And it was also balanced in our society with things like public libraries, so that everyone could get access to the information, though the authors were able to sell the information to the library and therefore survive that way. What I see happening today with intellectual property is that the big players who are the producers, not the writers, not the artists, the writers and the software programmers are the ones who get the least money for what they produce. But these people are taking this over as very big business and getting tighter and tighter control. They really don't care how much of the information gets out there or whether the information is necessary for us to develop more as a society. All they care about is their profit. And of course, the last person they care about is the writer or the software writer. And so we're losing that balance between the public good, the public need to be informed, and the need of the author to be reimbursed. And we're ending up with neither. The authors are getting very little for their work, and there's definitely more of an act toward keeping greater control and keeping information from getting out. And there was a question. No, the publishing industry... Actually, the publishing industry is not doing well. What's doing well is the multimedia and entertainment industries, and these are also covered by copyright law. And they were the ones who were there in force at the copyright hearings. The publishers themselves, the people like Dutton Addison Wesley, and those people were hardly visible. So it's really an entirely different group of people now who are the main producers of what we get as information. It's the movies, it's television, it's multimedia. So let's take another question.
I just wanted to add something to that. I never went to work for a computer company where I didn't have to sign an agreement before I went to work there that anything I created there belonged to the company I worked for. That is, I as a creator or a producer had no stake in what it is that I made. Okay, now I think that's one thing we need to be clear. Writers frequently are required to sign away their rights to what it is that they produce. Now, in the big picture, I think that what we need to do is dissociate the two different things, the creation of work and the distribution of it. That is, with the current system that Danielle Steele may be fabulously wealthy and a writer who writes obscure work may be incredibly impoverished, but it doesn't, you know, this. The market is a terrible arbiter of culture.
And well,
that's an absurd question. And no. Was that a question?
If you want to live in a world run by AOL, go ahead. I want my liberty.
How about whatever you can make money?
Go ahead, go ahead. If it's not going to devolve into an argument, can someone else please speak and ask questions? You can bring up your cat file.
No, I already signed the contract.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah. No, it's, you know, it's like after 8 months of being unemployed, it was kind of the idea of a paycheck was attractive, so. Yeah.
Yeah, and for more about that, this is a... Oh, I'm sorry. That he's basically talking about the fact that the government, the federal government especially, those states as well, tends to make, right now is making, rather than distributing its own information, and making contract deals with companies to distribute the information, and you can only get this government information by buying it through this company. And what that means is that information that's being gathered by our tax dollars, often about us, is not available to us without paying for it. And there is an organization, the Taxpayers Assets, which is run by Jamie Love, which is a Nader organization, in which he basically has a whole campaign to try to free government information and make it available to the public. And this is a strong movement that's happening right now. But at the same time, the government is cutting back on the government printing office and basically, you know, saying that it can't afford to disseminate its information and therefore it's going to be shuffled out to the commercial vendors. Well, it needs to be equitable price for equitable data, and of course oftentimes what they do is say, if you don't have any money, we'll give you raw data, but if you do have money, you'll get data that's nicely organized where you can do searches and you can find what you need. So this is definitely a problem, and our government is tending to sell its data rather than disseminate it. Other questions?
Vince Dyer standpoint, we give free testimony, we give our importation of census, which goes into the National Trade Database. I'm much more than charging $390 a year to buy our database.
Yeah.
So our manager said, okay, we'll sign your agreement, but now you're going to pay $600 a year to get our information.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is another wonderful thing, which is government agencies selling each other their data back, yeah. There's only one major difference between British and American copyright law, so I assume that their publishing patterns don't really have to do with that, but more with the economics of their publishing.
Yeah, I just wanted to turn to one of the problems about selling the book. That shouldn't be available. Okay, I just sold my first novel. One of the problems is now, of course, is that you just have my book being posted on the internet, and then people just download it onto their files. I don't get royalties, but you physically buy the book. And you could say, well, in the library, well, you have the same thing where a person could, you know, take your book off the shelf, make photocopies of it, and then read it. So that takes a lot of effort and a lot of time. Part of the problem is publishers and authors to say, I'm a normal person, I'm not a big conglomerate, I'm a guy just like you, I pay bills, pay taxes, and everything else, okay? I need to get paid. I want my publisher to sell my book so I see royalties and so I can get advances from the future. So the problem comes up is if books become good into the electronic domain and people just decide, well, we can download it, and there is not some capability where maybe you can view the book on or access out of the book, say on the net, and then if you want the book, even electronically,
right. This is definitely a problem, and this is what has spurned basically these new proposals in terms of the copyright law. With people, it's the first time that we face the fact that copies are this easy to make.
Right. But I guess that's
right. Right. So the question is right. So the question is how do we get the proper money to the author in this environment where copies are this easy to make? Now, for one thing, I think that the writers of books, as Bruce Sterling says, I mean, he put his book up on the net, and he says, no one in their right mind is going to try to read it off the net as opposed to go out and buy it. You can buy it for $4.95 at the bookstore. If you download it off the net, no one wants to read it off a screen, and it would cost you about $20 to print it out on your own laser printer. And then it would all fall apart. You don't even have it bound. But the people who are really worried are the magazine publishers, because an article is very easy to download. And we definitely have to resolve that problem. I don't think we resolve it by criminalizing people who make copies. I think we resolve it by finding a good way to get royalties to the author for their works. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes, and publishing is up.
Most of those titles, yeah. Ordinary people,
right.
Were not
right.
John Bishop, but even John Bishop, look, you want to get rich, you can write a good story that will get an agent's attention. That's one of the last legal ways that you can become a millionaire. The point is that publishing is the true, one true industry that's truly open to anyone who has a good idea. In that stuff, if they want to talk to writers, you have a good idea and you can write and put it together, you've got to deal with it. Publishing what I'm saying is that don't confuse the corporation,
right,
that's owned by Paramount, it's owned by Viacom, with
the original writer, exactly.
We are people who spend hundreds of hours, I'm sure we're creating a computer word processor, hoping that you'll like what we write.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, of course, the net gives you the possibility of self-publishing and therefore skipping the 80% that the publisher takes off your work, right?
Right. But on the other hand, the publisher, because most of the time,
Yeah, hard copy book. Right. Don't have, right. Yeah. Well, I suspect that this argument has nothing to do with the world of hard copy publishing. I don't think that hard copy publishing and the people who are interested in making money off the net have much of an intersection. I think we're talking about two entirely different worlds. I don't see hard copy publishing. I think it's going to go on the way it has gone. I think people are still going to want to read most of what they read on paper, especially if it's of any great length. What the big boys are looking for out there when they get onto the net, when they start making their deals, is they're looking for a new world of, at best, infotainment, but probably entertainment. It is mainly the entertainment companies that are really investing highly in this technology. And they are looking to make big bucks by getting us online and keeping us entertained online for as many dollars as they can get out of us. And as I say, at these copyright hearings, there were almost none of the traditional hard copy publishers there. It just isn't their bag. In the back. No, I don't have any advice for you. I mean, what type of advice are you looking for? How to stop people from doing it? See, at the moment, you really don't have a way to stop people from doing it, and this is what's holding up commerce on the net. Right, right. But no, but he's saying, how can he keep someone from stealing the information on his website? Yeah, I mean, yeah. Why don't, could you, like, yeah, stand up and say it to them? Otherwise, I have to repeat it.
Well, I might add that the AZT drug was developed primarily with federal funding, too.
I know a lot, actually, about the digital, online digital, because that's what I do for a living. I work on the information system for the University of California Libraries, and we do put information up digitally. What we do find, though, is almost everyone who retrieves something wants to print it and take it away with them. And I also feel that it's not going to happen quickly, but I think we're going to evolve as we get to that more and more of our information is on a screen. We will no longer be producing information in units of 300 pages. I don't think that that is the appropriate format for screen-presented information. Instead, I think that we are going to come up with something. The book exists mainly because we have paper and we have printing. And there were not 300-page thoughts prior to having the technology of the book. I think the technology of the computer is going to provide us with a different way to present complex thoughts. I think it's many, many generations away. I mean, it's way beyond our lifetimes. I really don't think that taking a book and simply digitizing it and putting it on a screen is appropriate technology. This is why the big push right now is in multimedia, because people feel that that is the better technology for using a computer rather than putting text on a screen. Text really works much better on paper. I guess one more. Yep.
Why have I paid for quite a bit of money for technical support and printed manuals? That's why I bought Windows. That's why I paid for That's why I paid for my business stuff. Let's face it, information became different to the property. You're not going to be able to protect the actual program itself. But if you support the thing itself, you will get
Thank you.